episode 7 of Minorities in Publishing. This is Jen.
This is Bev.
And we are at the other press office in Midtown, Eastside, and we're really excited to be interviewing Anjali Singh. You know you can contact us or just keep updated with us via Twitter at Minorities in Pub. You can also keep up with us via Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. And you can email us at minoritiesinpublishing@gmail.com. And I believe that covers our
all bases. The usual places. Thank you for everyone who's now following us.
Yes, has continued to and has been excited about everything in regards to diversity movement. So we really appreciate it. And we hope you continue to listen and enjoy our episodes. So is there anything else?
I think that's it.
Okay. So we'll get right into it.
Yep, we're here with Anjali Singh, who's the editorial director at Other Press. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for coming down.
Oh, yeah, totally. So Other Press publishes a range of titles across genres. And with your experience at, you know, large houses, mid-size, and indie presses, do you feel like indies are paving the way for greater visibility for diverse trade books and authors? I'm thinking of this because places like Your Press, The New Press, Akashic, and Grey Wolf generally have proportionally larger multi-ethnic lists per season than the Big Five, and we'd like to think that that's a trend that will continue, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd like to think it's a trend that will continue, too. I mean, it's such a big question because I don't really know the big houses' lists intimately. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think the reason we're having this conversation is because who's making the decisions about the books that are being published? And when you look at who's working editorially in mm-hmm. the Big Five, it isn't a particularly diverse group of people mm-hmm. and who have made that sort of a commitment. And then I think to be generous to that side too, I think it's very, I don't know if this is going to be that generous, it's very, very, very bottom line driven, and mm-hmm. I still think that there's, if everyone kind of in power still has a perception that the minorities aren't your audience, or that minorities aren't reading, that minority books are for minorities, let's say, mm-hmm. or that they're not mainstream. Mm-hmm. I mean, having said that, of course there have been minority books, like, let's say, Khaled Husseini or other authors who have found a huge readership in America. But I think it's a certain kind of book that
yeah.
has legs or is perceived to have legs. I don't know. And then there's, you know, another big piece of it is academic marketing and mm-hmm. which companies are really in place because to support that. And academic marketing is generally a way that minority mm-hmm. titles have a long life and kind of get established in the mm-hmm. culture and certainly in educational institutions. I don't know.
Yeah, and certainly from my point of view, I think it's nice that, you know, indies are putting books out there by people of color in a trade way, you know, whether or not they're doing them in, like, they're not doing the big marketing roles that, say, you know, one of the Big Five might do,
right.
But, you know, these authors are getting to have, you know, their first book be, like, you know, a nice maybe, like, 1995, you know, that might actually be available in, you know, stores book out there, and I think that's a nice way for, you know, people of color to support other people of color and have their, you know, give them what they can in terms of helping them be out there in terms of their visibility as authors and artists.
Right. Well, yes, everyone wants to be well published.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen as often as one would like, right?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, we spoke about that in a previous episode with Ivan about the perception of minority books being for minority. If a mm-hmm. book has a disabled main character, that's for disabled people. Whereas, and the problem is that
right.
they're not being seen as mainstream.
Right.
So that's been a, like, recurring question or
right.
concern
well,
in our discussions.
I was also thinking about, like, I feel like we're so, 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 so far away. I was like, well, you know, how many African-American editors do we have? How many African-American editors do we have whose beat isn't actually African-American literature? Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Like, we're so far away from sort of, like, whatever that... I mean, colorblindness is a... That's a complicated term, right? Because,
mm-hmm.
well, it's complicated.
Yeah.
But yet that feeling of, like, you know, I'm a literary person. I'm a literate person. Mm-hmm. Like, all of literature belongs to me. Publishing, I feel like, doesn't perceive it that way. And it's hard to know, sort of the chicken and the egg. Like, I always wonder, I mean, I think that I would always have been drawn to the kind of stories that I'm drawn to because of who I am. And at the same time, and I mentioned this in the Guernica piece too, I mean, at the same time, you're shaping yourself to what the perception is of what you are going mm-hmm. to respond to. Mm-hmm. And then that's what you get at the end.
Yeah, and it's nice to have that mix too, because like, from my point of view, I mean, I would be very happy to be if I was working on like an imprint that was strictly, you know, Latino based or something, mm-hmm. I would be happy for that. You know, that would be something that would be of interest to me, but I don't think that everyone who's in industry should feel like that's their goal. Like, you know, that shouldn't, they shouldn't feel like they have to fill that slot, you know, just because, and then that should be like an option. But like, and it's also not as much of an option, like, there's not, like...
And yet there is no list that you could possibly work on, so you don't get to make that choice anyway.
Right.
But we do end up, I mean, we do end up in the kind of nonprofits or the places that are, doing, sort of fighting the good fight or mm-hmm. doing the book because books because they want to contribute to the cultural conversation, which mm-hmm. happens occasionally in the Big Five, but not all that often.
Mm-hmm. And, like, to that end, do you feel like book publishing can actively change from within the industry to not just put pressure on artists and writers of color to make wholly relatable stories? Because I feel like that's always the thing, you know, everything has to be relatable to everyone, you know, for it to be, you know, a trade book. So we've discussed issues of marketability in past episodes and how these like limitations permeate lists of all types of houses, and like, we'd like to know what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, that's a really big question. Can publishing change? I think it will. I think it has to. I don't know how quickly it's going to change. And then that's another also really big question from the writer's perspective. Do they feel that pressure mm-hmm. to produce something that's quote unquote relatable? I mean,
I think there are definitely people who don't, but I feel like I've heard that there are people who do feel like that. You know, they're editors, or even later down the line when they're doing publicity, that when they're doing interviews, like, they have to make sure that it's like accessible to everyone, you know, whether or not it's a hard story of some sort, you know, it's like, it has to be something that everyone want to pick up, because, you know, it's tough to get people to buy books in the first place, so I relate to that, but like, at the same time, I don't know if it's, people should always feel like they have to make their stories relatable.
I mean the conversation is also about like limited resources in the Big Five houses, right? Mm-hmm. So they're only going to do the most mainstream kind of outreach. And if a book seems like it has a more specific audience, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. they don't want to touch it because, not even they, I mean, the editors too are sort of nervous about, well, I don't think I'll be able to get the kind of support this book needs.
Get off the grounds
from here. Which is, I'm back to the question of why I think the smaller houses are better. The decisions are more personal. It's not mm-hmm. so P&L driven. And they also know that they're more light on their feet and they can be more dynamic. And they usually have a better ratio of publicist marketing sort of manpower.
Definitely.
Per title. So,
and definitely working at Indie myself, I know that we're not doing the like, this is the 3 months you have with this book, and then you will never think about it again.
Right. It's like you keep it in mind and then think about what book that comes down the line that relates to this book.
Yeah, and I will spend like a year doing not even just like backlist pitching, but just still, you know, being in communication with the authors for like about a calendar year, I'd say, like with their book in like a pretty active way that wouldn't happen if I was manning a list of 60 titles or, you know, per year.
So. And the window is really, it really is like what, like 6 weeks to 2 months?
Yeah, it is.
That's your window.
So it's, yeah, I agree. I think it's a nice fit there that hopefully will continue to be in place. I'm glad you mentioned your Guernica interview because I loved it so much.
Oh,
but
yeah, we both really enjoyed it.
But and in that
I know
interview,
it's what brought you to me.
In that interview, you mentioned not coming from a traditional immigrant background and how, you know, if you're a person of color whose parents were immigrants or working class and who struggled to put you through school, they want something more secure for you. And you know, that's something we've talked about here a little bit before, but do you have specific ideas on how to change the class breakdown of those entering the publishing industry Or do you think we have a long way to go before that's even a possibility?
I've just been reading the Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace, and it feels like it relates because that have either of you guys read it?
No.
You know what I'm talking
about.
I know,
yeah, about the book.
I mean, because it's so much about race and class in America, and like this kid who was so smart and sort of given every opportunity and seized every opportunity, ends up at Yale, and still there was this huge cultural divide, you know, what he felt, who he chose to be friends with, how he lived, and then how he chose to kind of construct his life afterwards. I haven't finished the book, so actually I don't know that much about his post-Yale years, but what made me think of it is that I feel like entering publishing is a lot like entering an Ivy League institution. It's very, not everyone obviously comes from the same background, and I also think that like in college, you sort of speak for your generation. Like, I don't really know that much about who's entering publishing now. I kind of have, you know, very sort of, I have the window of the people who are my peers who are minorities in publishing. Mm-hmm. And I would like to think that it's opened up more. But I have to say that, like, in my own experience, like, when the waves of layoffs happened, or, like, when I got laid off from SNS, it's sort of like, wow, you said you cared about diversity, but obviously it's your absolute last priority, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's actually doesn't count for anything. It's total lip service.
Yeah.
But, like, I remember in 08 I got laid off from Houghton Mifflin, and it was me and Lorna Owen, and who is also Asian-American woman, and it wasn't in the same year, but then Rakesh Sachdev got laid off from HarperCollins. So I did sort of feel like looking, and Amber Qureshi isn't working right now. I did feel like I'm looking around me, and my fellow minority editors are actually not, you know, moving forward or being supported. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it was like an element of hubris, but I was like, well, if I'm not there, who's going to buy these books? You know,
yeah.
Who's going to buy these books?
Yeah, yeah.
Who's going to buy the books that I would care about? And as you know, when it's your own experience, you have a very deep-seated understanding of, like, who else would care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's not your experience,
yeah,
it feels like no one would care.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, did I answer the question? I can't remember where we started.
Yeah.
Oh, about whether or not I thought publishing was opening up. Well, since you guys are actually a slightly different generation from me in publishing, you've been in publishing 10 years?
Yeah,
Jen?
11.
11, and you've been in publishing?
9, 10, yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Not even. I mean, you guys have actually put in paid your dues, but like you're much more involved in the world of now minorities in publishing. What are your feelings? Like, do you guys feel hopeful?
It depends. I mean, I've noticed it's funny that all three of us are at small presses.
Yeah.
And the diversity element at a small press is very different from a larger press that I know I started at, because I could say 50% of the people in my press are, you know, of various backgrounds.
Right.
And I know I wouldn't find those numbers when I was working at some place that was 500 plus.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So it's weird, because then when, like you get into the bubble, you're like, oh, my place is completely diverse. And, you know, they're like, everyone in production is a minority. This is great. And then you just go to maybe Random House and you're like, wow.
Right.
I know. I feel mixed about it. I don't necessarily feel hopeful for various reasons. I feel like unless the industry does change some very basic old guard elements of it.
Like paying people?
Like, exactly.
Yeah.
That's been my big thing. I know Jen has heard a lot about me about this, but yeah, I think that like, unless there's some room, I know it's never going to match, you know, entry salaries for engineering and finance and other things that like, you know, very talented recent graduates are bringing and able to enter into, but I think there needs to be some small shift in that area. You're asking a lot of young people to, you know, commit themselves to this type of career for what will never be a high salary.
What will never be a high salary, I feel like, for, like, just related to that question of, like, when you're an immigrant kid and your parents want something stable for you, this industry has, like, increasingly...
Yeah, unstable.
Well, yes, that's it.
Unstable. And then divide between the salary and actually what the cost of living is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, salaries did come up. You know, when Random House came on the scene, they went from, like, 20 to 30 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what starting salaries are now, probably 35. But that's...
It's 30 to 35, which is crazy.
Which hasn't changed much, right? Because it was Random House. It was 30 at Random House
was,
12 years ago.
It was
30
when I
much.
Got my first job
yeah.
in 2005. So, and now it's... like 35 maybe at some places. So
at some places it's 28 still.
It's still 28, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Not good.
And then when you know, a room in Bushwick costs $1,100 a month. Right, so that there's still this element of like both but being subsidized. And then I think beyond the financial consideration, I think about this some too. I mean, it might be also specifically because I'm coming from editorial and agents, you're supposed to, you know, bond and be best friends. Mm-hmm. And I think this is true for many people in publishing. And it's one of the things that's special about it is it forms like this little world within a world. It's like a little mm-hmm. village that you belong to within New York City. But I feel like so many people in publishing, it's their entire social circle and their entire world. And that world, it's very, very insular. Mm-hmm. And how you both break into that world and how you make that world value the fact that we should expand,
yes,
and we should diversify because mm-hmm. it's going to be good for all of us and be mm-hmm. good for the industry. Anyway, it was sort of back to the Yale analogy, which is that you've now entered in this world and you kind of have to fit into this world. And there's not really there's a little circle. There's like a little circle within the circle. Like, of course I feel closest. I really do feel closest to the people who have really different experiences. Like mm-hmm. Aisha Pandey was a great sort of mentor to me when I met her.
She's such a wonderful
person. She's also half Indian. She was an editorial. Like it was like, oh, you know, there were so many ways in which we related. And of course, until she came along, who was that person for me? Like I didn't mm-hmm. have someone who I felt, I could look to. So she was like an older sister, I would say. And then, or like there's an agent, Stephanie Abu, who's, you know, also French and, you know, Jewish North African. Like there's just a way in which we kind of experience publishing and see the world that feels very, like we kind of really get each other.
Yeah.
We're like this. And so I think about like, well, would my experience in publishing have been very different if I didn't? Yeah, I mean, you never know, right? I am who I am. But
yeah, and it's interesting that you...
But those are the people I'm interested in and want to hang out with. It's not everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very insular kind of community. I mean, like, I always am interacting with other publicists, obviously, and, like, talking about things, and we have a lot of, you know, common tastes in literature and reading and, you know, culture and, you know, just general interests in general, but, like, it's interesting that, you know, we're not a very diverse group ethnically. So it's like these people who I feel very close to and, you know, we relate to each other on many levels and, you know, are going to all the same readings and things. Right. But like, it's, you know, it's what you said about pushing the boundaries of that and like encouraging mm-hmm. people to why we should open up this mm-hmm. world and, you know, make room for different types of people is a good question because I feel like there isn't always room for that conversation, certainly not in our day-to-day working lives. Like, I mean, there's many priorities that we have to, you know, get to daily. And, like, it's just, like, I would be nice to see space for talking about that. Especially, like, for me, I'm not early on anymore, like, you know, so I'm not, you know, necessarily knowing people who are coming up as much. But, like, it would be interesting to...
I mean, I do think, actually, some of it is outreach. It really is the fact that the way most people find out about careers and jobs is because mm-hmm. someone in their family or someone's mother, sister's aunt. Like, I got my first job in publishing because my aunt had gone to boarding school and her, you know, friend from boarding school who lived on the Upper East Side had been an editor at Viking and she knew lots of people and she gave me lots of, you know, that opened a lot of doors for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
As to the fact that I had gone to Brown and so I had, like, you know, I had that mm-hmm. Ivy League degree on my resume. And then, of course, the rest is, you know, being yourself and being a reader and whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it is just, like, where are those resumes? Who are those?
Yeah.
When you're a smart minority kid and a really good university, do you even know publishing exists? I didn't know publishing existed. I mean, it was pre-internet, but it never occurred to me. Like, I just, I don't know. I still don't really remember when the light bulb moment happened. I just remember that I liked books and I liked reading. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how am I ever going to find something to do that pays me money to do something that I like to do? And somehow it kind of clicked. But of course, my aunt having that connection helped a lot.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, so I think that a lot of people actually would, maybe it's just lip service, but would say, oh, yeah, we'd be totally open to having, you know, minorities in publishing. But the resumes aren't landing on my desk. Right. And I think that is a little bit true. They don't. Yeah. Of course, they're also not color coded.
My name isn't very
exactly, but I mean, like, mm-hmm. like so much of publishing is about those personal connections.
It's about relationships
and who knows who, and so it's not even just the resume landing on the desk. It's the resume landing on the desk with the endorsement from someone who you who you know and trust.
Right. Yeah. Because the pool is so wide. Yeah. I mean, it's never like, you know, it's amazing the, you know, how many applicants there are for entry level positions that are right. just like, exactly. Absolutely. So
but so many people are discouraged before even trying. Well, yeah. there's the salary, and then there's the I don't know the right people kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. And this, yeah, I mean, it is, it's a world that until you belong to it is actually a foreign world.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, we mentioned that a bit. We're talking a bit about, like, the need for connections in an episode we did on publishing programs and why more people are going into publishing programs to try and get that in.
Right.
And then still feeling like they're not, because they're competing right. with their classmates. And if you're one of two minorities
right.
in a class of 50 people, like, how do you get the attention right. of that right. professor, quote-unquote, who right. works in the industry to say, you should hire me. You should.
And it's just, like, an interesting thing, too, because the whole reason those programs exist are to make that connection so you know someone
yeah,
who
Yeah, but there's
you know,
still
like,
the competition element, yeah. whether right. it's cold, you know, right. a cold resume being landing on someone's desk, or if you know someone and... Hopefully you'll get the endorsement, right. but there's no guarantees because you're like a face in a crowd.
Plus, those programs cost money.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I didn't do one of those too.
Yeah. Did you do a program?
It was in my undergrad, so but I never did the graduate ones that Columbia and NYU
right.
offer, which are very
expensive,
exorbitant.
Yeah,
I just knew I couldn't
have
do
a master's
it. I was
in
like,
publishing is very right. interesting,
but also a little odd. Like, I mean, having a master's in publishing does seem odd to me. Maybe there's some element, like maybe
yeah.
if you are going to be a managing editor and copy editing and all of that,
yeah.
But most skills you really learn, like publishing
yeah.
is your graduate school. Or maybe that's just to make me feel better because I never went to graduate school. But
it's also not
yeah.
as comprehensive per se. Yeah, because some are very editorial focused
right.
and not very marketing. Or I landed in production, but
right.
everyone kind of
starts out saying, I want to be an editor because that's the only thing you know. Yeah.
Exactly.
So I think that's a problem
right.
too, is the education
right.
element is. Even if you're going into a program and finding out about publishing, are you getting the information you need to go to the right place? Because
right.
maybe you're going to editorial and there are 1,000 resumes
right.
for
that
editorial.
That was so interesting, too, from that episode.
Production.
When they said, one of our guests said that her program was very focused on being an editor, which was very odd to me because, like, there are more jobs in publicity that are available.
Yeah.
Like, why would you tell this whole... you know, class
yes.
that, you know, they should be getting these editorial
right.
skills when there are
right.
way fewer job options
right.
for them. Like,
yeah.
Well, and also, I mean, as I tell anyone in publishing, I mean, publicity is also, well, I think any first job you get is very helpful in whatever you end up doing, because
mm-hmm.
if you end up being an editor, having had experience as a publicist is pretty great and all of that, but publicity, you move up much more quickly, and so you can be paid more quickly than an editorial, but the other thing that I mean, it's actually, they're very different. Like, being in-house in publicity means that you're dealing with a very, like, you have you're dealing with office politics in a much more specific way, and I think less about how you're perceived by
mm-hmm.
the industry. Not in a, I just, but it's also those jobs, marketing, publicity, production, all of that are probably less on people's, less on people's radar.
Yes.
But, I mean, I don't mean to minimize your experience. Like, as a minority publicist, how do you feel like being a publicist does it seem different than if you had been an editor? Did you feel like the road to being an editor was open? Do you feel like
it
impacts
is,
how
I mean,
you're
like, seeing? I agree with what
yeah.
you're saying, because, like, my public persona isn't about the books I acquire.
Yeah.
You know, as a publicist, I'm working, you know, I'm signing my name to things, and
right.
I'm, you know, pitching people, but, like, you know, I'm not known as, you know, the... person who acquired
right.
X book. So, you know, there is that, I agree, there is that kind of, there is that little shield, and, like, I don't know, I think, I mean, I love it a
uh-huh.
lot, and it, you know, I enjoy the skills with that. I don't necessarily feel like being an editor was ever really necessarily open to me. I mean, I didn't really love it anyway when I was
right.
an editorial assistant,
right.
but, like, it didn't feel like something that would necessarily be cultivating, you know, that I would be
yeah.
as a young person, that I would be cultivated towards that, you know?
Right, like, you feel like you steered yourself away from it, but there are probably all these signs steering
yeah,
you away from
bit.
It too.
Yeah.
Mentorship
yeah.
was lacking too, I think.
Yeah,
I didn't find much mentorship when I was an editorial assistant either, so unfortunately, sorry to say, previous
yeah, I mean, and there are all these, like, you know, wonderful excuses for that, oh, we all have so much more work to do, da, da, da. But, like, I kind of think there is no excuse, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we all want to be part of this community, mm-hmm. and it is a community, then mm-hmm. that's what the older generation owes yeah. the younger generation. But you do hear so many horror stories. I mean, real horror stories mm-hmm. about things that editorial assistants or other assistants are subjected to, you know? Yeah. I mean, that has nothing... I don't know if it has nothing to do with the minority question, because I do think that, like, if you're a very privileged... You come out of a very privileged place, it's probably easier to put yourself in that demeaning position than if you are someone who's had to, like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps or whatever it is. You feel like a minority. And not only are you the minority, you're being sent to get the dry cleaning and somebody's lunch. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, that's just... That kind of like apprenticeship
that
probably
of,
might be less comfortable.
That type Absolutely. Of thing yeah. has a lot to do with class. I feel yeah. like, you know, there's a certain type of parent, a certain type of family that feels okay about their child doing this, you know, culturally valuable position where right. they know, you know, they understand that eventually this will lead to something.
Right.
And they are okay, you know, they're like, oh, they're working their way up and this right. is the dues they have to pay, and they sort right. of understand that. And like, you know, not upper class or, you know, not necessarily, you know, not English speaking families right. won't get that. And, you know, they're just
like, they don't want the hard earned money for college. You don't want them, you know, wasting their brain cells. But I think also there's this process of attrition, right? Like mm-hmm. so many people start as assistants and very few move up. Yes. And so I think, yes. especially if you're trying to decide whether to stick with it, if you're looking around you and you're not seeing any other people who look like you who have actually gotten any further, it's much harder to like Absolutely. Understand why you're making this sacrifice.
And plus, you know, the lack of stability as yeah. you, if you're reading, yeah. you know, in like PW Daily about layoffs and things like that, you know, and you're thinking, I'm putting myself out there and I'm doing mm-hmm. this and there aren't people like me yeah. and it might not.
Right.
My yeah. job might not be there right. in a couple of years. Yeah. It's all a lot in the mix to yeah. Yeah. commit to.
I know I'm the one being interviewed, but do you guys feel hopeful overall about publishing? I mean, I think you do because you're having, you know, you're doing a podcast.
I'm sticking with it. So. I think it's just finding your niche, which we said, I think, a first or yeah. second episode is I did have a really good boss who really did apprentice me mm-hmm. and was looking out for me, and my current boss is very leaves us to be very independent because mm-hmm. he trusts us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to have that and to know you've established yourself mm-hmm. and just have stayed with it. And I'm sure for you it's probably been hard to go through like different houses
starting over every time. And then yeah,
just like
that's...
doing that. Like,
and then that, I mean, that sort of, since you can't separate race from any other piece, like, it also coincided with being a mom, you know? I mean, like, yeah. the fact that I had a child and got laid off on maternity leave, and then I had a second child and got laid off, and, like, you know, I felt very, very, very unsupported by my industry that I had given so much yeah. to. Yeah. Even if, you know, you can make the best of it, or certainly I profited personally, too. Even if career-wise it was hard, I got to be home with my kids, and I got unemployment insurance. Like, that was a subsidized maternity leave. Most people don't get that. But no, I mean, I think, like, yeah, I think that I think we have a very, very long way to go in terms of an industry, in terms of like supporting working families, right? And like, mm-hmm. I think as a country,
Definitely.
We have a long way to go. But no, so yeah, starting over with like my home life had changed so much, so that as mm-hmm. an editor, you're expected to be wedded to your job and mm-hmm. read and edit every weekend. Yep. And of course, there are times in your life when you have an ailing parent or a young child that you can't give as much. And I think if you've been in a place, I mean, this also speaks to the instability of the industry, that if you've been in a place a long time where you're very well established and trusted, then I think you can maybe carve out a little bit of space.
Mm-hmm.
You have your authors, whatever. But if you get laid off and you have to kind of keep starting over, you don't, there's no long leash for you, right? It's just yeah. like the results are supposed to be immediate, and you're supposed to prove that you care about your job more than anything, and you have to build a list. So yeah, after that happened to me twice, I was like, no, I just don't have the energy. I don't have it in me to build a list again. Mm-hmm. I just need to recover a little bit. Mm-hmm. But then I did sort of feel like I died and went to heaven when I landed at Other Press, because as we were talking about before mm-hmm. we started recording, it's an incredibly diverse place, and the values feel very in line with my mm-hmm. values. So it did sort of, I felt like it bore out that cliche of, you know, when these things happen, you do end up in a place that's just actually a better place for you.
Yeah.
So I'm working part-time, and trying to kind of do both, and the pressure of acquiring isn't on my shoulders because our publisher does the bulk of the acquiring, but I read French. She's Francophone. We buy a lot of books from France, and we buy a lot of books for just what feel like the right reasons, because right. they are contributing to the cultural yeah. conversation. We just bought this book that's a response to Albert Camus' The Stranger from the
oh, really?
By an Algerian French writer who lives in Algeria, and he wrote it from the perspective of the unnamed Arab's brother. So there was an unnamed Arab shot at the in, mm-hmm. and The Stranger, and this is like 50 years later, the brother is telling the family story. And Judith just did a great PW interview about it, and just like, yes, like this mm-hmm. this is so interesting, and great that this is like what the mission is. We're doing a book about hunger around the world by an Argentine journalist. I just feel very like proud and excited about the books yeah. that we're publishing, and I felt like the corporate world, at least my experience of it. It felt sort of like kind of weirdly deeply corrupting, that like you really had to think about yourself and your books and your book's value entirely through the prism of how many copies they sold.
It's very anxiety inducing to have to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how can you make any kind of, and so I guess that's not my apology for corporate publishing, but think of all the editors who are living mm-hmm. with that pressure every yeah, day, exactly. and then how difficult it is to go out on a limb when there are going to be layoffs in the next 6 months mm-hmm. and yeah, it's not, yeah, there's not still, a lot of risk taking. There's yeah. not a lot of risk taking. And unfortunately, publishing works by minorities that don't seem to be obviously, you know, hitting that sweet spot between commercial and mm-hmm. Literary and obviously bestsellers. It's a harder call. But like there was, and I don't know the story here or anything, but I just remember when I heard Malika Adero got laid off from Itria, it was like, oh my God, another one down, you know? Like,
yeah. She's had a huge like yeah. longevity there,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, and it's a completely profitable imprint. Yes. And so why was, I mean, I'm sure there were many reasons, but I just thought, even when you've had a longevity like that, and I think, yeah, the leash is very short, you know? Mm-hmm. Sure, you can have your passion projects, but you might lose, your head might roll.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I agree in terms of, you know, working at Indie, it's really a wonderful experience to be able to, you know, promote books that I'm proud to be a part of. But, you know, at the same time, there's a limited number of jobs at Indies, too. So it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
it's, you know, I think one of the things to do is try to figure out how to make, you know, the big five jobs a little bit more hospitable to diversity, which is a really long-term goal
yeah.
in terms of, you know, being hopeful about the future of publishing. And I think one of the things that does make me hopeful about, you know, the future of publishing is that people are willing to talk about, you know, the issue a little more openly of then, race and then in the past.
You think so? Like, what do you bit. Think? Why do you think that happened? Or like, or was it just that people got interested and started asking questions?
I think it's still like, and yeah, people are interested. I think it's also just the sheer numbers of race in America. I mean, mm-hmm. like as we move, you know,
right
further down the line, you know, there's just more people of color in general in the right. U.S. and I feel like it's becoming more glaringly obvious which right. fields they're right. not in, you know, so
yeah. and right. also the internet, like people are much more vocal on the yeah. internet, you know, sometimes not rightly, you know,
right,
but yeah, I feel like people, you can't ignore it anymore.
Yeah, people can't ignore it when people keep tweeting about something, yeah. you know, like it's just sort of,
or why did this person say that? That's offensive. Don't they know that this is offensive? Or yeah. right. And it kind of like, oh, right, there's this audience out there that we're not considering.
Right.
Reads Time and The New Yorker and The New York Times and things like that.
Right.
So, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it is. It's like kind of like we do have the blinders because we're with these small presses, like we said, so we're just like, it's great. It's great where we are.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you forget. It's like, right. yeah, but these bigger monopolies kind of right. hold the power, and then they're buying right. each other and merging. People are being laid off. Imprints are being created. Imprints are being shut down. Right. And what are the imprints bringing in terms of diversity? Is it like the Black imprint, the Latino imprint, the Asian imprint,
right.
the
But those are even less around anymore.
Right.
They're not
yeah,
even
I don't
like they're
know
like
where they are.
Or, and even like as I said, man, what I want to see is like editors of color who are not actually
mm-hmm.
Expected to be publishing works
mm-hmm.
exclusively by
exactly.
writers of color, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like they shouldn't have to shoulder that, like, you know,
yeah.
just as they're
right.
part of being part of the cultural conversation.
Right.
You
right.
know, it's just
right.
like. But like going back to what you're saying, do you think that how would you think lists, like, or houses of all types and sizes can make editors feel like their contributions are shaping the list, because I think that's something that an editor should feel like.
I think that they do. I just feel like the cynical part of me is, right, the editors are shaping themselves to what the house is asking of them. Mm-hmm. The house is asking them to publish books that are going to sell lots of copies, so right. It's like this, like, very closed system. Mm-hmm. But I don't, I mean, you'd have to go out and talk to more editors. Mm-hmm. I think most people probably feel, well, either they've made a kind of cynical decision to work on a kind of book that's kind of divorced from, like, their true values, mm-hmm. or they are doing what they want to do. It's just that, like, what they care about isn't the same things that New Press and Grey Wolf and other press care about, you know? So, does that answer that question?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Did I miss a piece of it? It's a big open-ended, I mean, it's sort of...
How do you think can make editors feel that their contributions are shaping the lists?
Because I think I agree, sometimes editors just feel like they're doing this thing and they're, you know, they're filling that slot, they're getting that book that's going to make the numbers, and I feel like they are...
I mean, I think I've been fortunate enough to actually work in places that were very editorially driven.
Mm-hmm.
Houghton Mifflin, and then... weirdly, SNS, at least in the window that I was there, John Karp came in. He was the publisher. He really put editors at the top of the pyramid, and we made all the decisions, and I could go to him and say, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So I did have that luxury. You're still living with that stress because it's all on you, right?
Yeah.
Is this book going to sell, and are people going to get behind it? But I think that question feels like it's getting at sort of just the larger shape of, like, well, what happens when you're part of a corporate structure, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like a lot of my experiences were just related to business decisions that were being made that had nothing to do with me as an individual, and that was very painful to live with, right? When you work for a corporation, you are inherently not seen. You are a worker bee, right? I mean, depending on the size, right? So, I mean, I think that's also the answer to why being in a place like Other Press feels good, because I can be exactly who I am because I work in a small place and I'm seen and I'm known.
Mm-hmm.
But in those, this was trying to answer the question about the sales-driven attitude, which is, editors care about sales because you want people to read your books and you want to think that you have, like, identified something that resonates with other people and you want to keep your job. But I've never been in a place where the sales force was saying, this is what we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in a big corporate place, do you have an identity? I mean, I feel like you also have to kind of fit in with the culture of that place and with the kind of books that they're doing and kind of meld with that. And maybe that's the other reason why being a minority editor anyway isn't so easy, because that culture, you're shaping yourself into, I mean, I don't know, minorities work in corporations all the time, right? but I think a lot of corporations are a little bit more sensitive than
And I mean, like, values and is a big part of it. You know, in your Guernica piece, you talk about working with Sony Meta, and, like, you felt that you had, you know, similar values, and that, you know, that made being...
Well, that there was a cosmopolitanism, like a real understanding that there are other places in the world and people, and seeing them is important. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Representing their stories. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like that fundamentally. But I think this is the piece that, like, I feel like I've learned, or I'm starting to learn as I grow older and work in all these different places, is that, like, there's just also the culture of the place. Mm-hmm. So there was Sunny, and he was a very visible minority man. But Knopf also, and I wish I knew more about the history of Knopf, but it was founded by a German man and always had a culture of books and translation and pulling from around the world.
Right.
And I think that was a total contrast to a place like SNS. Like, they started as a crossword book publisher, you know, like, and they did a lot of celebrity bios. I mean, I think Diane von Furstenberg just published her memoir that I was like, every time I turn around, I see SNS. But, like, I'm like, oh, right, but culturally, that is an odd fit. Like, that's, I feel like it does kind of determine what the place is and what they do.
And like, who lands there and like, who thrives there.
Right.
Like, you make certain choices about who you're going to be editorially, and that will, like, shape your trajectory and your choices.
Yeah. I guess I think I didn't give enough credit, at least early in my career, to, like, how much the culture of the place. Like, you are a one lone individual, right? It's actually, I felt like I could do Persepolis because I was in a place that knew how to do Persepolis. They could see the value in it, but they also had the tools in place. because both on the graphic novel side, because they had published Mouse and they'd published mm-hmm. Jimmy Corrigan, and it was a tiny little French comic book collective that published it in France. Very alternative. The whole comic scene in France is, you know, there's a whole alternative scene. And they only did it because I was able to say, with us, because mm-hmm. I was able to say, we published Mouse. We're not like this big, bad corporate American entity. Mm-hmm. Or at least we know how to do this book. Right. And so it was like everything sort of coming together.
Yeah.
The culture of the place and then what the book was. So, I mean, I would like to think that Persepolis would have been successful anywhere, but like what a company like SNS have really understood what that project was or known mm-hmm. how to do what
yeah, they needed to do with it. That's what makes great books happen is when they land at the right places. And, you know, these people are skilled in this area, you know, and they have...
And I mean, I talked about academic marketing at the beginning, and I kind of meant it in that context of, like, those trade books, like a Persepolis, they're not academic books, but where they can really have a long life is in the classroom, mm-hmm. and it's... Knopf has been very good about, like, they have their own academic marketing department, like, devoted mm-hmm. to... Because it is so important for the kind of NPR, you mm-hmm. know, books that are that have that kind of depth. Yes, you're going to find sort of readership casually in bookstores, but really you're going to find a readership amongst students and professors and in the academy. And how do we get our books on their radar? So that's kind of what I meant about academic marketing. It was more like a really certain companies, and I think Other Press is one of them, and certainly New Press is another one. Like that's like a big part of how you're reaching your readers.
Readership and the natural fit audience I think so. That's great. Is there any other things you'd like to talk about? Anything upcoming you'd like to...
Oh, well, I mentioned the Kamel Daoud, the book that's Response to the Stranger. We're still working out the title in English. That will be next May. Oh my gosh, you're really putting me on the spot. What do we have coming up that I'm really excited about? we just acquired a book. The contract isn't even signed, but you know, publishing is a handshake deal. That's by a young Arab writer named Salim Haddad, who is based in London, and he's writing about being a gay man in the Middle East. It's a novel. It's a debut novel. Mm. But it's really eye-opening. It's exactly the kind of fiction that the reason that I want to publish fiction. And mm-hmm. And what's so interesting about him is he really grew up with quite a mixed family, with very multilingual, and he spoke English with his mom and Arabic with his dad, and lived in many different countries in the Middle East, and then was educated in Canada, but does a lot of aid work in the Middle East and speaks Arabic, so he like really is of the place, mm-hmm. but can write it in English. It would still be effective if it were a work in translation, I think, but there's something very special about someone who really has one foot in both worlds and can write about the experience. So it's called Last Stand at Guapa, at least for now. Yes. And it'll probably come out next spring as well.
Awesome. Last Stand at Guapa?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Send it on the Goodreads.
But that's so great. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Your time.
We really
fun.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was so great. And...
Our next episode is going to come out after Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving.
In the interim.
And our next guest is going to be a follower who's been with us since, I guess, the beginning.
Yeah, she's been really supportive, which is awesome. Preeti Tubers is joining us, and she does school and library marketing at HarperCollins and is also a contributing and writer over at Book Riot and Bookrageous, so it's super cool that she'll be here.
Thank you so much. So we are so appreciative of all our guests who've agreed to be on the show and who've been supportive, have listened, have tweeted. So we can't express our appreciation enough. So thank you,
thank you so much. Yeah,
and thank you guys for doing this.
Thank you all,
and we will see you next episode. I didn't say next week.
Good for you.
And again, have a great holiday.
Thank you.
Thanks.